Hello, everyone. I want to talk today about what it means to be on the other side of the so-called machine learning revolution, give a sense of these experiences, and reflect broadly on their significance in relation to technological governance. My main argument revolves around the idea of context sensitization and the importance of moving beyond the abstraction of computer science research and computational thinking. By the end of this talk, I hope you might be willing to consider the role of context sensitization in the work that you do that can not only stimulate rethinking around trustworthy machine learning systems, but also different ways of doing scholarship in this area. This appeal to context sensitization derives from two main experiences, the first of which is the primary and most important. That first inspiration comes from co-leading Our Data Bodies, a multi-sided participatory study of privacy, data collection, data-driven systems, and marginalized communities in the United States. The second experience derives from my involvement in co-organizing an independent program on critique and reflexivity within the ACM Fairness, Accountability, and Transparency Conference this past January. What I have observed is that a vast gap exists between different communities of practice or epistemic communities, such as computer science researchers and members of marginalized communities. My talk has three parts, as the title suggests. In the first, I reflect on context. In the second, I introduce my research on data collection and data-driven systems in the lives of marginalized people and what they have said or done to challenge or refuse technological systems. And in the third, I share some perspectives on abstraction in computer science research and computational thinking. Since this is a workshop that showcases privacy and security-related research in machine learning systems, and I am not a computer scientist, let me situate my terminology. To be clear, my use of the term context sensitization is inspired by the work of ethicist Clifford Christians and communication theorist James Carey. In their review of what constitutes the logic and aims of qualitative research, they cite to the importance of contextualization in investigation and analysis. You must become a master of context. You must be able to speak to the complex specificities of a situation or phenomenon. You must be able to step outside of these complex specificities in order to understand their relation to or connection with large systems and broader histories. Doing so does not imply some sort of analytic movement from the particular to the general, such as focusing on an individual brick and bricklaying until you have an entire building. Instead, they argue, you must start from the broad setting and from the perspective of interconnection or intersection between things, actions, phenomena. And contextualization means having a fluent command of the histories, meanings, relationships, and the significance of connections between them. What I'm describing refers to a distinctive disciplinary trait. While some strands of social science make their mark by emulating the natural sciences, the qualitative tradition that Christians and Clifford's valorizes recognizes humans are living actors in an unfolding drama of life. Because of this, the qualitative tradition seeks to avoid reducing humans, or worse yet, dehumanizing them and their social practices. Rather, qualitative research seeks to build understanding of the different processes by which humans, quote, produce and maintain different forms of life and society and meaning and value. Context is imperative to qualitative research. Of course, the drive to humanize or to contextualize, as opposed to abstract or reduce, is not the sole domain of the social sciences. Humanistic motives in research are available to all, not just the humanistic social sciences or humanities. And from where I stand, I believe that computer science has claimed that mantle in small and unique ways. One idea that comes to mind immediately is computer professionals for social responsibility and its opposition to computer defense systems and to computer science and military research collaborations. I mentioned this in part because I was a student in the Bay Area and very well remember its public sphere project, though there are non-US examples too. The second, and perhaps more germane to research, is Phil Rogway's recent work, which was introduced to me by computer scientists, and which shines a light on the material impacts of cryptographic research. I'm sure you all know this text, but indulge me as I go through it for myself. For Rogway, math is never just numbers or just an abstract process. Math is political. Mathematical models are deeply connected to how we create and organize our lives together on this planet. So we should be asking important questions about when math is humanistic and when it is not. Mathematics does not just comprise numbers and abstract computational processes. And I'll just mention there are others, including work developed by younger graduate students, computer science students, that also reflexively question the broader social, economic, and political context of machine learning research. But I'm unable to get into them here. Rogway's dictum, math is political, is critical because it illuminates the broader context in which computer science research is done. It looks at the larger forces that connect mathematical models to social systems, political institutions, and economic activity. And in this manner, I see Rogway's work as an exercise in context sensitization. He is sensitized to the ways in which human subjects are living actors in an unfolding drama of life, and the ways in which cryptographic research intersects that drama. If we were to extend his provocation to research on machine learning systems, it would not be looking at how to bring complexity or diversity of the social life into mathematical models, but rather it would be drawing connections between mathematical models and the complex world in which their findings, truths, discoveries will meet. This includes the money needed to invest in them, the infrastructure that sustains machine learning systems, the institutions that steward these systems, the parts of the planet that are used to power these systems, the workers who keep them operational, the political mechanisms that are transformed by them, and finally, the people who must interact with machine learning systems, users. I'll come back to these points and reflect on the importance of context sensitization in the third part of my talk. But for now, I want to move on to introduce our data bodies, work that I co-lead and that I believe can illuminate the lived contexts for members of marginalized communities dealing with data-driven systems. I want to focus particularly on the idea of refusal to accept the terms and conditions of data-driven systems in the way that institutions and the people who work for them offer. Refusal is significant, in my opinion, to the argument about context sensitization, because in some ways it reflects the sentiment that some members of marginalized communities simply do not want technical solutions or technological forms of governance for societal problems or systemic hardships they face, or to solve systemic hardships they face. That drive for contextualization is one of the facets of the work we do at our data bodies. Here's a little bit of background. We are a research and organizing coalition driven by justice, equity, and human rights, and we aim for our work to build with organizations involved in fights for racial justice, LGBTQI liberation, feminism, immigrant rights, economic justice, and other struggles to help us understand and address the impact of database technologies on social justice work. We work in Charlotte, Detroit, and Los Angeles, where we are gathering and sharing stories of everyday surveillance and oppression which take place in people's encounters with data-driven systems and the institutions that manage them. By data-driven systems, I should add, we refer broadly to statistical and automated systems. And we are not expressly or explicitly addressing machine learning systems, but they are certainly pertinent to our research. We're a 5-person team, and we're community organizers first and researchers second. Mariela Saba is connected to the group Stop LAPD Spying Coalition, Stop Los Angeles Police Department Spying Coalition. Tawana Petty is with the Detroit Community Technology Project. Tamika worked with Center for Community Transitions, a reentry organization. Kim M. Reynolds is a writer, organizer, and artist based in Cape Town. And I should mention Virginia Eubanks, who published the book Automating Inequality, was an original co-principal investigator and left the project in 2018. Between late 2016 up until the end of last year, we completed 140 in-depth interviews with individuals in these three cities' most marginalized neighborhoods. We also completed what's known as three reflective focus groups and conducted more than a dozen participatory workshops that essentially allowed us to understand how best to talk about all things data without stoking fear about data-driven systems. We actively tried to avoid creating paranoia or putting words in people's mouths, which is a lot harder than it seems. In the spirit of contextualization, it's important to note that these cities differ in size and have unique histories. We entered communities in each city from a different starting point, a different starting context to tap into their histories. So in Charlotte, the country's second largest financial capital and a city with high rates of imprisonment and recidivism of African-American populations, or in African-American populations, we concentrated on reentry, citizens returning from prison, and employment. In Detroit, a city that reeled from municipal bankruptcy and the Great Recession of 2008, we entered our research from the angle of utility shutoffs, evictions, and foreclosures. And in Los Angeles, a city with the third largest metropolitan economy in the world and home to an unhoused population in the city of more than 35,000 people, our starting context was on housing at the intersection of criminal justice. These entry points have provided essential ways in which to situate what we heard from people about the pain they experienced when, for example, providing their data or realizing data were being collected about them, and when interacting with data-driven systems. Neither data nor system is an abstraction that can be used to create a mathematical model. By and large, systematic hardship weaves through the stories we have gathered. For example, people talked about being caught in a cycle of disadvantage in which data and or system was one part. So after leaving jail, you can only find a temporary residence. When you go to apply for a job, you are denied. After listing your criminal background or the address of a temporary shelter where you live. So you get stuck in a perpetual rut. Or if you get lucky and are able to land work, your luck can go only so far. As Jill, a charlatan, explained, I pled guilty to worthless checks in 2003. That's almost 15 years ago, but it's still being held against me. Basically, all of my jobs have been temporary positions or contract positions. I could go on with these stories of hardship and further elaborate similar kinds of experiences, but I actually want to draw your attention to the different ways in which members of marginalized communities are responding. This also speaks to the aims and logic of context sensitization in data-driven research. From a substantive point of view, the research of our data bodies speaks to the profound need for democratic reimagining. This process involves a reimagining of political possibilities beyond the quote-unquote solution space that currently seems to define or the political possibilities that currently seem absent in mainstream conversations I've witnessed, for example, in fairness, accountability, transparency, or trust research. Let me unpack this below. So at the same time that we heard about systemic hardship, we also heard about refusal. People we talked to refused to settle for the data-driven process systems or processes of data collection that were handed to them. These forms of refusal, I contend, affirm the self, often in relation to a larger group or one's community or one's collective. These forms of refusal assert one's agency. I want to review three forms of refusal here because they directly implicate how, when, and why we prioritize technical forms of governance, say engineering trustworthiness, fairness, accountability, or transparency in systems, over other forms of governance. Rectification. So the first is refusal as rectification. Allow me to introduce the story of Mello, an older Black woman who is unhoused and living in the Skid Row area of Los Angeles, or who was unhoused and lives in the Skid Row area of Los Angeles. We interviewed her after a long struggle to get housed through the coordinated entry system, a system that functions as a sort of match.com for the nearly unhoused, the nearly 40,000 unhoused population of Los Angeles. Coordinated entry is powered by a scoring system called the Vulnerability Index, which is generated through a survey that welfare administrators pose to prospective housing recipients. Virginia Eubanks has also written about this. A resident of Los Angeles for 10 years and unhoused for 4, Mello fought tooth and nail to be placed in housing and refused to be defined by her data. And she credits her doggedness as the reason for her success. Despite being an at-risk individual who should have easily scored high on the vulnerability index, she had been repeatedly denied housing. She could not specifically identify the reason, but she felt that she was being denied housing because she was outspoken. For example, she had discovered fraudulent shelter managers who demanded residents pay for shelter when in fact shelters were already receiving benefits from the city or grants from the city. She saw security guards at shelters sexually harassing their residents. She heard shelter workers tell her to eat rotting food and sleep in bedbug infested beds. She had witnessed the death of a friend whose diabetic condition went overlooked and who died while showering. Each time Mello could reapply for housing through the coordinated entry system, she was met with denial and told, quote, your name has red tape on it, end quote. But just as she was dogged in documenting and reporting abuse at shelters, she was dogged in documenting her own needs for housing and appealed. She refused to accept the terms and conditions of a data-driven system that the city tried to present to her. Fortunately, eventually, she challenged the data used to categorize her, rectified her record, and was granted housing. Mello's story of refusal is one of individual resistance. In this next story on obfuscation, the refusal similarly chronicles what individuals are doing every day to deny the people and institutions who manage and implement data-driven systems the ability to control and manipulate people like Mello. But unlike Mello, who sought to accurately represent herself, Ken, also based in Los Angeles, actively worked to misrepresent himself. So misrepresentation is key for Ken. It's a key way for him to assert himself, to assert his personhood in a context of discriminatory state action. And this misrepresentation I equate with obfuscation. When Ken spoke to our data bodies, he explained his long history of struggle. A Native American man, he felt like most people around him targeted him just as the U.S. government had targeted indigenous people since in the 19th century, always wanted for dead. Ken struggled with mental health, drugs, and alcohol. He was kicked out of shelters and had to live on the streets where law enforcement routinely harassed and abused him. In one instance, while Ken was sitting down in front of some out-of-order public toilets, the local police tried to arrest him for trespassing. Ken countered back with the claim that cops were harassing him for no good reason. When the police asked him his name, he gave them a false one. He deliberately misrepresented himself. And this prompted one of the cops to respond, "Well, it's not in the computer." And after several exchanges, the police issued him a ticket without a surname. As soon as they left, he tore it up. Clearly, Ken was practicing refusal. And it's a refusal against a database-dependent police practices. Like Mello, he refused to accept the terms and conditions of the data-driven systems presented to him. But in this case, he obfuscated his identity in order to remain excluded. And he did so in order to protect himself against a carceral system that, again, basically wanted him for dead. So far, I have described two individual-level examples of refusal. They show individuals working against and within data-driven systems to get their dignity and their due. There's also refusal at the level of organized populations or communities, what I and others have referred to as a sort of tech abolitionist spirit. In Detroit, Tawana Petty, who I introduced earlier, and whose home organization is Detroit Community Technology Project, Tawana has been leading efforts to claw back the city's attempts to rapidly roll out cameras with facial recognition capabilities. Called Project Greenlight, the program has promised real-time crime fighting, and last summer boasted of partnerships with 550 institutions, including schools, churches, health centers, and gas stations that would stream images back to police headquarters. For abolitionists in Detroit, the term trustworthy or fair real-time facial recognition doesn't make any sense. There can be no trust or fairness in a data-driven system against the context of broad disinvestment in social welfare, predation, especially subprime lending and its legacy, gentrification, such as the so-called redevelopment of Detroit's downtown, or a media barrage of demonizing narratives regarding Detroiters, especially Black Detroiters. It's a majority Black city. Before the global pandemic, Tawana had been working with allied community organizations, tech privacy groups, and policymakers throughout the city, and had been showing up to police commission meetings. She, in particular, has marshaled the stories and insights from our data body's research, stressing the ways in which community members articulate their needs for safety and belonging, more so than privacy or security. the Detroit Police Commission has moved on some of Detroit Community Technology Project's recommendations, though held back on others. Since the global pandemic, the situation has become more complicated. So while the collective efforts, the sort of abolitionist approach to facial recognition technology has met with some success, the situation is now far more complex. The Michigan State Senator, Senator Isaac Robinson, who had proposed a moratorium on the use of facial recognition technology and who was actively drafting facial recognition technology legislation, recently lost his life to COVID-19. And COVID-19 has hit Detroit in profoundly disproportionate and devastating ways. It is hard to say whether banning facial recognition is a real possibility on the horizon. But with that said, it is without a doubt that Detroit Community Technology Project, in coalition with other local and state organizers, set the bar for collectively challenging the inevitability of data-driven systems advocated by state and private actors. Before I get too lost in the current situation, I want to stress for you my larger point. Whether it's refusal as rectification, refusal as obfuscation, or refusal as abolition, the people with whom we spoke want a decent life. People wanted access to resources to live. They wanted to be recognized as a human being, not quantified. People wanted respect from individuals and institutions that they came into contact with or whose services they depended on. They desired meaningful human relationships and interactions. People wanted to be able to love themselves for who they are. So I'll pivot here and try and address next, in this third and final part, the problem with abstraction. And this is my bridge back to computer science research. So what are we to make of these stories and strategies of refusal? I see strategies of refusal as part of a larger demand for liberation from cycles of disadvantage and for the dismantling of interlocking systems of oppression. Forget about human-centered machines or humans in the loop. Forget about bad actors attacking systems from the outside. Forget about how machine learning systems interact with nature. Between the various acts of refusal and the visions that we heard articulated in Charlotte, Detroit, and Los Angeles, members of marginalized communities call for, in many cases, radical transformation in the institutions that run the world. They call for distribution of power in society, and they call for changes in the dominant narratives that attempt to demonize marginalized people over and again. Charlatans, Detroiters, Angelenos want changes in the ways that individuals understand, value, and relate to oneself, to one another, and to the planet. And they want changes that lead to their lives being filled with possibilities. As I said at the beginning of my talk, I mentioned that I have witnessed a tremendous gap between epistemic communities or different communities of practice, such as between computer science research communities and the communities our data bodies is from and works with. I've heard computer scientists often talk and present their research in relation to real world problems, as if researchers and their research are separate from the real world. At my first computer science conference which happened to be the one where I voluntarily co-organized an independent program on critiquing and rethinking accountability, fairness, and transparency, I also heard bald claims of machine learning. I also heard bald claims that machine learning systems are here to stay, so we might as well do something about them. And I read or listened to papers that tended to disappear people into mathematical equations. In contrast to research endeavors and disciplines that seem to abstractly relate to people in their lives, what I've presented here with our data bodies research is far more visceral. The practices of refusal don't dwell on the internal mechanics or constraints of systems, but technological systems in conjunction with social, political, and economic systems. And they also dwell on technological governance, but only in conjunction with other forms of governance. At a basic level, the problem which needs solving is that marginalized people are demonized, deprived, lack effective opportunities to participate in the shaping of their destinies. At a more granular level, the problem is that designing and implementing data-driven technologies, even when well intended, can constrain people and their fields of action. What is the point of tweaking data-driven systems to be fairer or more trustworthy when they make institutions even colder, even more calculating, or even more punitive than they already are for marginalized people who use their services? What is the point of tweaking data-driven systems to be more private and secure when the companies that control their production and diffusion siphon resources away from the social support and public infrastructures that marginalized people need to live a decent life? As Tawana, my colleague and collaborator recently wrote when reflecting on our current times, said, "Why is there increased and even supposedly limited purpose surveillance when it does not prevent Black people from dying? When some households still cannot get water? When air quality is still abysmal? When people cannot get the reliable health care they need? What is the point of this technology or these technologies?" What I'm describing is a profoundly different vantage from which conversations about technological systems begin. And frankly, the so-called more pragmatic approaches found in computer science feels kind of like a taste of the impassive and profoundly undemocratic forms of technological governance that have yet to touch all populations. The processes of abstraction, the inability to humanize, the eventuality that technological systems make choices for humans in ways that we cannot easily track or intervene in. This, what I would call a culture of abstraction, is a real world problem. Though, with some effort, maybe this real world problem is a tractable one. As I mentioned in the first section of my talk, I do think there are examples to follow and a sensibility that can grow. At a minimum, the path towards context sensitization can involve framing questions in terms that different communities of practice might pose. So instead of health versus privacy and security, maybe the frame could be expanded so that it acknowledges resource distribution problems. Rather than building more technology, even the technology that is privacy protecting, how might collective well-being be improved if tech companies were taxed at higher rates, and that money went into public coffers that help governments respond to public health needs. Or simply more put, what would happen if instead of making machine learning systems more accurate, trustworthy, or robust, we focused on making companies contribute their fair share to society? That's just one example of widening the lens and scoping societal problems. And it definitely clashes with disciplinary traditions. But if discomfort is the price we must pay for producing new research, that cost pales in comparison to the consequences of letting abstraction prevail. Now, before concluding, I want to share my minimum, that is, what I and researchers and organizers like me ought to commit to, too. After all, we're all in this together, and I am a guest in your house, and I am very grateful for the invitation to speak at this workshop. At a minimum, I ought to commit to and do better at translating between computer science and social science. I know I could do more to identify when the experiences documented by our data bodies, when these experiences do align with the problems that computer scientists can and do address. Discussions about adversarialism that are described in Kulinich et al.'s paper would appear to align with the disobedient practices of refusal that I've described above, and that gives me hope. I have a sense that there is much more. I know I need to connect more with computer science research on archiving or evaluating user feedback and embedding this feedback in social systems. But the communities that our data bodies comes from and works with need you to help us too, so we can get a better sense of where and when we are in alignment and when and where we are not. Between this friction and alignment, I think change can happen, and I look forward to imagining those possibilities with you.